Welcome to Credit Exchange, your weekly podcast where we speak to the biggest newsmakers and news shapers in finance. I'm your host, Lisa Lee. This week, my guest is Juhi Dhawan, macro strategist at Wellington, an asset manager with over $1 trillion in AUM. Welcome, Juhi.
Thank you, Lisa, for having me on.
Juhi, the Iran-US war rages on. For a brief moment, it looked like the Strait of Hormuz was reopening. But today we have news that the US seized an Iranian vessel and the Strait is again shuttered. This has real implication for the price of oil, inflation. And every single week, every single day, there seems to be a new headline that changes the macroeconomic landscape. In this kind of a market, in this kind of geopolitical dynamic, how do you even do your job?
Well, I'm excited that we have a seat at the table. Macro has become increasingly important for portfolios and for market participants. And I think history helps us. I think understanding the geopolitical shifts taking place help us. And then understanding the range of scenarios is a way that we use to try to size up what could be coming our way and how best to think about trades in that environment.
So let's unpack that. Let's delve into that. Because right now we've got oil prices that were above $100 a barrel, but now it's come back down. Who knows what the direction might be? But given, if you're taking this scenario that maybe the war does wrap up, what has this done to your expectations of growth and of the economy?
Given where energy prices are today, we believe the shock for the economy is manageable. Okay. The United States came into this year with some of the most accommodative fiscal and monetary policy set up in a few years. And that creates some buffer for the economy to withstand these higher energy prices. Clearly, there are winners and losers, but the U.S. in particular, because it is now a net energy exporter, really sees more a shift in the pattern of growth, whereas there are other countries in the world where the hit is larger because they're net energy importers.
You and I are sitting in London, and that is where I think Europe is going to feel a bigger hit. So can you help me explain a little bit more of what's going to happen in Europe, and particularly in the UK?
Yes. So as you said, higher reliance on energy imports means a bigger hit to production and consumption patterns as the economy deals with that higher energy price. I think a big theme for us coming out of this crisis is one of energy security getting another boost higher. And we do think already with the Russia-Ukraine conflict that occurred, Europe started to diversify its energy sources. Relative to that first conflict, we believe Europe's a little bit in a better position because it already started that process of diversifying. But you are absolutely right that Europe, Japan, even certain countries in Asia will be much harder hit than the U.S. was in terms of what we expect out of this war.
But what if it doesn't end right now? What if we have a prolonged closure of the Strait of Hormuz? What if oil prices do go back up? Then what's your scenario analysis for that?
So the best way we find to approach a situation like this is to create thresholds. Mm. We find that I don't have a crystal ball through which I could tell you this is exactly where the price is going to settle. But what we can do is understand what would be the impact if we reach some tipping points. Mm. So to help our investors, we create these scenarios where we understand if, say, the price were to roughly double, the impact starts to become more visceral than if we are still in a range where prices may be up 30, 40, 50%, but not yet over 100%. So by creating those thresholds, we decide whether the hit will be more manageable, more acute, and at what point do recessions come into play. And then once we do that, we start to think about the policy offsets that could allow the range to flex in some ways or the other.
So let's talk about the most realistic scenario. I know it's impossible to understand when this war will be over and how long it will go. But given sort of maybe we say that it will be feasibly winding down in a couple of weeks, we have shaved some growth in GDP, right? But are you anticipating a recession at all? Because a lot of the investors and managers that I talk to are saying their corporate growth is still fine, that these energy prices haven't really trickled down. So let's talk about corporates first, and then I want to really touch on something I know your specialty, which is looking at the consumer and the K-shaped economy.
Yeah. So you're right that the duration of the shock will matter for how much we can manage the aggregate hit to growth. But what we see today still suggests to us that while it makes sense to take, you know, depending on the region, between 0.5% and 1% off of the growth rate, it still leaves us with positive growth numbers. There are a few exceptions in Asia where I think the growth hit could be quite severe, but many of those places actually have more policy space to counteract.
What are some of the counteracting? What are some of the things that you think that governments can do to mitigate this pain?
Something that we could see are tax relief on gas tax holidays, if you will. In the United States, we've already seen a couple of states try to pass this. But we expect in parts of Europe and in Asia, this will be an important piece. India, which is one of the harder hit countries, for instance, has not yet really allowed that passage to come through, which is helping protect some of the corporates. It also means that consumers who tend to be very price sensitive are not seeing an immediate hit. And that's why the governments with space are able to at least delay and hopefully avert the worst with the expectation that eventually the war will die down. We are expecting that energy prices stay higher than where they were pre-crisis because we have lost some capacity in the Middle East because of the damage done by the war. But we are also anticipating that of the roughly 20 million barrels that go through the Strait of Hormuz, at least half of them come back into the market so that the worst case of how high prices would need to go gets taken off the table.
Okay, so at least we won't have ridiculously high gas prices, but they've already risen.
That's correct.
The weekend before, I was traveling in the UK in a car, and gasoline prices were definitely up. Yeah. My parents in Los Angeles tell me that gasoline prices are up. Yeah. So how does this impact the consumer, who is already feeling what you and I have talked about before as a K-shaped economy, where the bottom segment is doing worse than the top? This is going to just hurt them more, right?
Yes, it is. There's no denying that the energy is such an important piece of the consumer expenditure basket. And if you are having to pay, say, $50 a week extra in gas prices, it's really the lowest end consumer that feels it the most, because that's the equivalent of saying maybe one less restaurant visit in that week. So we do expect to see that discretionary spend part of the consumer, and especially at the lower end, take a bit of a rest as a result of this. And my hope would be that, again, if there are targeted measures for those places that can make a difference, that these consumers get some relief. In the US, for instance, part of the buffer that we talked about is the tax relief, which came in the form of some
big, beautiful bill. We haven't really got the checks, but they should be in the mail, or yes, some people might already have it in their bank accounts.
So, you know, it's not that much money, but it is on the margin really helpful at a time like this when people are facing that higher energy price. I think, Lisa, what's really important to consider is that when we look at energy expenditures globally, they're amongst the lowest we've seen in about 50 years. So the starting point is a good one. I think the issue is with the K-shaped consumer that we see is that affordability is stretched in aggregate because of housing, because of healthcare costs, and just the general inflation that came after COVID. So I think that's really where we're seeing a little bit more pressure coming into the situation, and energy itself has not been as much of a constraint until recently.
Well, let's shift to inflation, because now we're having, once again, higher inflation expectations, right? Central banks, US Fed included, were telegraphing that they're ready to do cuts. Now I think that's a little bit more mixed. See, they might pause. There's even a possibility they might hike again if we see inflation rear up. How does that change and factor into your macroeconomic view?
Yes. So again, when you asked me about what could be done, I sort of leaned into governments and not so much central banks. And it's really because of this inflation angle. Inflation tends to have the important impact of really staying the hand of the central bank because they are very concerned about their mandates. In Europe in particular, where central banks have a single mandate of inflation alone, this situation is squarely all about where will prices settle. And markets have actually moved to start to even price in the possibility that the next move is a hike in Europe. In the United States, it's a little different because we have a dual mandate central bank, and the dual mandate central bank allows the Fed to balance both sides of the equation in making a decision. But the Fed came in with above target inflation into this episode. So I think the messaging we are receiving very consistently from the Fed is they're in watch and wait mode, again, trying to assess how long this episode will last. But something about the Fed that's important to keep in mind is if it is a headline inflation shock like energy, the Fed tends to recognize it as a tax on the consumer.
Yes, you know, how much can you control really cost inflation when it's a supply shock like
that's
this,
right. Right. And so they tend to stay steady through such a period rather than tighten. But again, we haven't really had this experience in some time where they come in with above target inflation. As you know, we're also awaiting a possible change in the leadership at the Fed. So this week, actually in particular, if we hear testimony from the nominee, Kevin Warsh at the Hill, I think markets will be especially attuned to hearing whether his prior views, which lean towards a cut, have changed as a result of the circumstances that have transpired.
And to your point, the Federal Reserve Act does have a dual mandate, and let's shift to the labor market because we're seeing either weakness or perhaps just neutral. Like, we're not really creating jobs, it seems.
It's a fair statement. The job market has been going sideways, it seems, for a period of time. I think, though, the critical piece here is the unemployment rate.
Yeah.
And the unemployment rate has drifted a little bit higher from the lows, but it's been a slow move. And in most recent months, what's important to keep in mind is that now the expectation is that labor supply has also moderated tremendously
with
the immigration curbs. So the immigration curbs mean that even if we're printing very low payroll numbers each month, they are enough to keep the unemployment rate steady. Mm-hmm. And that means that even though 3 years ago we would have said these numbers are a weak job market, today we say these numbers suggest a labor market that's roughly in balance because the unemployment rate is staying steady. And so that's a big shift for the Federal Reserve to keep sort of trying to triangulate and say, is this really something we're going to react to, or are we just having to anticipate that, in fact, the labor supply only allows for this kind of job growth?
And one thing that's surprisingly has put something off the headline has been artificial intelligence, right? There's so many aspects of AI and the progress, the speed of change, but let's talk about, since we're now talking about the labor market, are we losing jobs because of AI, or is it too early to say? Because there is the job loss element and there is a productivity boost element, and I want to hit on both.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about how far has AI diffused?
Yes.
So our numbers suggest that roughly 20% of U.S. firms deploy AI today. But when we look at the employment picture, a higher percentage, 20 to 40%, comes to the forefront. And the difference is that smaller firms have been slower to adopt AI relative to larger firms, so the employment base using AI is higher. At those numbers, what we are observing today is some signs of labor productivity rising, so that's a good news, and I think very welcome, especially in the context of almost zero immigration, because Because if we don't have much in immigration growth, we need even stronger productivity growth to get the economy to stay, to grow as fast as it possibly can. So we're definitely seeing some signs. But what I would describe to you is the take-up of AI today is uneven. Three sectors, financial services, professional and business services, and technology itself, account for roughly 40% of U.S. output, but about 20% of its employment. Mm-hmm. It is in these three sectors we are seeing a potential boost up relative to the prior cycle. When we look at the rest of the economy, we find the take-up of AI is much lower, and the applications have not yet displayed an ROI such that the companies are rushing to adopt it at the same pace. So selective boost in productivity, yes. An overall aggregate boost, not yet. Maybe some signs, but not really that big push that can get you there.
Any projections when that might happen?
So our research looking back in history suggests we need to get to about a 50% diffusion rate for the technology really to start to show up in productivity numbers. And we also have seen that what really seems to make a difference is when we are able to see what we economists call total factor productivity start to rise. So it's not just the capital accumulation phase where we are today, but one where we see the widespread diffusion so that, if you will, the technology feeds off of itself and we're starting to see new applications. So we're not quite there in that phase, but the early signs in the sectors I mentioned
shows real progress.
Yeah, so there's really room for encouraging news, just not yet quite where I would say, you know, given that we just talked about inflation, not at the point where we could ignore what we're seeing on the inflation side because of productivity. Yes, we're seeing some good signs, but maybe we need to stay vigilant anyway.
But how about the job picture? Because everyone seems to be scared for their jobs. Everyone is thinking, how would my AI replace me? Every industry.
Very fair.
I go to a cocktail party and 30-somethings are like, oh, this is what I'm doing with AI. I might lose my job. I'm not sure I want to go into this field because of AI. How real is that fear right now?
I think the fear is justified to a certain extent, but it's also manifested itself because of what we discussed before, that there's been a cyclical lull in job growth in the U.S. economy. And so it's very hard to say whether that was AI driven or just a, you know, what transpired after a period of Fed tightening where the labor market just slowed quite a bit as the economy adjusted to the higher rate structure. My bias has been to say we're seeing signs of AI having an impact on certain aspects of the labor market, but much of what we have seen as the slowdown in the labor market has come more from cyclical factors rather than just AI. But to the extent that this is such a popular topic, maybe I will share. The area where perhaps there is more tangible evidence is at the entry-level positions for young graduates.
Maybe that's why my friends with kids graduating are the most nervous.
That's
correct. I thought maybe they were just nervous because they're recent grads, but
no,
you seem to say that there is actually some legitimacy to this.
So I think where AI has shown its greatest efficacy has been at those entry-level tasks.
Yes.
And so there is some sense that even for all the kids who've taken, you know, done coding or STEM-related fields, which were considered
such safe jobs,
such safe choices, are feeling a little bit of that stress of saying maybe not so easy to find a job. The reason that I say it's still selective is twofold. One, we're seeing the unemployment rate of those with experience and college degrees stay quite low. So it does seem to be. And the second piece is, again, because we had such a surge in employment that has now been coming off, it is entirely possible that we've just been in a period which has cyclically slowed down the pace of jobs. What we are watching and tracking closely are the number of companies or the percentage of job losses directly attributable to AI. Last year, that number jumped up to 5%.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But before, the year before that was less than 2%. Mm. So it's there, exactly. But 5% isn't dominant.
It's not like an apocalypse of jobs, correct. Right? That we'll all be unemployed and that's on correct. National like employment insurance of some type.
Exactly. So some validity, but maybe just to put in perspective, it's not the only reason we're seeing what we're witnessing.
I want to shift to the markets.
Yeah.
Because right now, the S&P 500, we're at a credit conference, credit spreads, they're really tight. You would never know by looking at just markets that there's a war going on.
I agree.
Is it because of all the enthusiasm for AI and the productivity gains? I'm trying to understand how this could happen, how the Straits of Hormuz, how energy could be closed, how energy prices could be so high, why there might be even like not enough oil for certain countries, and yet the markets are not really responding at all.
I am with you that at the surface, it looks like, how's this even possible, right?
Are investors that sanguine? Are that divorced from reality?
No. And so there are a few things going on. One is that I feel a little bit like a duck, right? Mm-hmm. The surface looks calm, but there's paddling going on underneath. And so there has been quite a bit of rotation in the market.
Oh, that's interesting.
So we've seen energy obviously take a pole position. We've seen great strength there. And we have seen other sectors, some of whom were duration sensitive or who, like consumer areas, which were quite hard hit when the news out of Iran came out. So we certainly saw some of that rotation, which on aggregate didn't look like much, but the standard deviation of performance between best and worst performing was quite extreme. The other thing that has been quite remarkable in this period, and it goes to your point on AI, is that earnings estimates have gone up.
Yeah, right.
And mostly, much of that has come in the AI-related areas. It could be power, it could be energy, it could be some of these areas. And what that has meant is that while we have adjusted the price earnings multiple, because the estimates went up, in aggregate, the market didn't fall as much as a result of what transpired. Now, if the Strait of Hormuz stays closed, I would venture to say that the price of energy will go back up some more, and there will be earnings estimate revisions downwards for those companies where energy is an important input, which is a lot of companies in consumer and industrial space. If it is the case that we are talking about a couple more weeks rather than many, many months, then the earnings adjustment has to be quite a bit less. And I think that perhaps is what made the markets react so powerfully when the first sign of ceasefire came out. Still, I think the market is really trying to adjust to determine the duration and the size of the shock. And for that, we'll still be watching.
Know, right? It's just they're so uncertain. I don't think anyone knows. I sometimes wonder when there's so much uncertainty, you just stop factoring it in.
Markets have a way of trying to figure out what is it that they can, what's the right way to price in a shock like this. And I think adjusting, if you will, the multiple of on which the stocks trade is a good way to express the higher uncertainty that the event is going to result in, irrespective of what we get.
Mm-hmm. But it is surprising the tone shift.
Yes.
Because I think when the war first started, there was a lot of worry and people were fearful.
Yes.
Now I feel like even if it's closed for a while, people are like, okay, it's higher oil prices. But to your point, we started off with oil pretty low.
Yes.
We've lived with $100 barrel oil before. And if it just shaves a little bit of growth, maybe we don't make as much money, but there's such enthusiasm for where the economy is going. When you look at some of the bank earnings, they were some of the strongest earnings you've seen, right? And to me, banks are like a lever played on the economy.
That's right.
And when they're doing well, I feel like that's a sign that the economy is doing well.
Yes. So again, we came into this period in relatively good shape, and I think market participants are giving the economy the benefit of the doubt and saying, if this oil range holds somewhat in this, even if it goes back a little bit higher, the market can absorb it because the economy can absorb it.
Okay, but let's shift to Europe and Asia, because we touched on it briefly, but going back a little bit more, and what's your expectation for those regions, because they are more sensitive?
That's correct.
Are they going to be okay if this is prolonged? And if they start slowing down, could that be a drag down on global economic growth that even the U.S. will feel?
So I would describe one of the surprises when we look at the historical performance of the economies and markets to oil shocks. One of the surprises this time has been China. China has reduced its reliance on oil because of the big push it has made in renewables, because of what it has in terms of high reliance on coal, as it turns out. And so this market has actually held in better than what it would have done historically in the event of such a shock. Now, this matters for good and bad reasons when we think about the global economy. Well, it matters for good reasons because China is, again, a very important driver of growth. So the fact that it can hold up better is good news. The not so good news, if you will, from all of this is that China comes in already at a very competitive position from a manufacturing standpoint relative to Europe, relative to Japan, and some other countries in Southeast Asia. So one of the questions we are asking ourselves is, will China again gain competitiveness as Europe struggles with this energy shock, as Japan faces this energy shock, and China ends up being relatively better off compared to what its past would have suggested?
Which is also puts more pressure on international trade and calls for...
That's correct.
...the world trading or... Which we, by the way, we no longer even seem to talk about tariffs, right?
We can come back to tariffs. What I would say about Europe in particular here is that we continue to think this is going to add to the pressure for the Europeans to continue more organic growth drivers and diversify that energy base. So a lot of focus on the grid and sort of how to think about energy sources that were diversified already with Russia, Ukraine, but continue to do that. And then for Japan, we think actually we might see nuclear get restarted.
Yes, right. I was going to say, this is going to be in a nuclear renaissance because Germany's pulled back, Japan pulled back.
That's correct.
And yet, if you're going to move away from oil, I'm not sure that you can totally also move away from nuclear.
That's right. And so for Japan, we think the option of restarting some of that nuclear exists and probably will be taken up. This also will put a lot of focus on what the fiscal plans are going to be in Japan and how quickly they can come to fruition, because again, Japan is a relative loser for being an energy importer. So we'll be watching that part. And then I guess the final piece that I would mention is, and it probably takes us to tariffs, but like maybe preempting that a little bit to say, a critical question is, will this change the trajectory of trade flows even further?
Right? Which Donald Trump has really tried to reshape.
That's correct.
And I know the Supreme Court validated his set of tariffs, but there are other ways that the administration can impose tariffs, and I believe the administration is trying for those.
Yes.
He is trying to reshape the global trading order.
That's correct.
And how, and we, this year we've been so busy, we don't even get to this now, but what are you seeing? How successful is he?
Yeah.
Is manufacturing coming back to the U.S.? How are supply lines being reshaped? I mean, we had a WTO system that has worked really well since World War II, maybe not perhaps well. There were broken things about it, right? But it was a system that we knew.
So it functioned,
yes. We're now in a new era.
That's correct. And I think that the rerouting of supply chains that we saw last year when the tariffs were really quite aggressive, for instance, on China relative to other parts of the world, saw China's trade within U.S. imports almost go back to levels that we saw in before they joined the WTO.
Oh, wow,
so it's a big drop. And the big beneficiary, on the other hand, was Mexico. Because a lot of that rerouting, one, China brought some investment into Mexico as a backdoor way to get access to the U.S. market, but two, U.S. chose Mexico as that hub for much of the manufacturing footprint that used to be vertically integrated into Asia. So we've seen that. The counterpart when we think about what's happening in Europe and Asia is actually growing trade linkages. As many countries decide that they would still like to pursue trade, and this is opening up opportunities for closer cooperation for intra-Asia trade in particular, and we've seen some very good signs of that, but also Europe starting to have conversations in Latin America and elsewhere for trade deals that are coming to the forefront because of the less clarity on the U.S. direction of trade. I think in this context, even though trade is in the back foot right now because we're focused on Iran, it's a good reminder that this is the year where USMCA negotiations have to begin. Doesn't mean we get somewhere or not, but this is important because for many U.S. companies, Canada and Mexico are really in the top trading partners, and they need to figure out whether they would need to move those factories in that North American hemisphere, or do they need to really bring it into the United States because tariffs could get impacted adversely even in these two countries. Our best sense of what we see today is that Mexico has actually done many things to address some of the concerns of the Trump administration, but we still think there's a tough negotiation ahead. But Canada, if anything, has been even more problematic in finding common ground.
Yes, and then also verbally and very vocally.
That's correct.
Fighting with the president and with this administration.
And so again, Lisa, that goes back to your new trade alliances being formed, but also a really shift in patterns on how different countries will react to the circumstances that we're seeing.
So I've asked you a number of questions. We've hit the energy, war, AI, trade, anything else that you think is really important as you do your job and lead a team of macro strategists?
Demographics?
Can we
talk about demographics?
I forgot about that. Yes, please.
All right, because there's some truth in the demographics is
destiny. Right?
Yes, there is some truth in that. So I'm going to use a really simple example to make this point. And so if we think about the immigration curves that we've just seen in the U.S., and if we think about the trajectory of growth in any economy, demographics is a big part of how much an economy can grow. On our current trajectory, by 2030, the natural birth and death within the U.S. population will result in zero population growth. So if there was to be literally no immigration, there would be no population growth by 2030, and in fact, it would head negative in the subsequent decade. We do expect that immigration will settle at least to a small positive number that keeps things afloat, but it reminds us that what immigration policies will be followed globally will become an important competitive factor in determining which countries actually succeed in managing their economies through what is obviously a very challenging older population profile, which is going to put pressure on public finance, right? So we know...
Yeah, we're already seeing it in so many places now.
That's correct. So if you think about the projections, which by the early 2030s, Social Security is supposed to go bankrupt, essentially, in the U.S., this is really because we're seeing this population rise, and those older people, we've made a lot of commitments, and the funding will exacerbate the pressure on public finances. So I think, I ask myself, when I think of the 2028 election, will this be a president who is an AI president?
Yes.
In terms of like regulatory change and AI or labor market concerns that we talked about? Or will this president be an immigration president? And I think these might be a couple of important issues that become platform issues for whoever comes to power next.
Because it is going to be the dominant theme, the dominant topic.
That's correct.
Of our time.
That's correct. And so the demographic shift that is underway, we already see its impact in Japan quite forcefully. Mm-hmm. And we see how much Japan has done for participation rates for women or so on to continue to try to stretch that demographic out. And I would hazard a guess and say that, broadly speaking, immigration and the umbrella of labor policies really becomes the lens through which we determine relative winners and losers in much of the developed world, and even countries like China, who are aging very rapidly, because who gets this policy right might actually be setting their countries up for more sustainable growth in the future.
Right. Oh, that's fascinating. Thank you so much for joining me. This is such a great conversation and so timely, helping us understand the macro environment that we live in right now. Thank you so much, Judy, for joining us.
Lisa, my pleasure, and I look forward to our next conversation. Right. Take care.
And to our audience, thank you for joining us for another week of Credit Exchange. Do follow us on Spotify and Apple, wherever you get your podcasts. This has been Lisa Lee. Till next week.